You're listening to Investify, preaching financial independence and assisting investors to achieve a more flexible and free lifestyle through smart financial planning and real estate investing. If leaving the corporate world and jumping into this thriving industry is what you desire, tune in and listen to stories of like-minded individuals who made the leap to financial independence.
What's going on, everybody? You are listening to Investify. My name is Craig Kurlop, aka the Fi Guy, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Chad, the Realtor. Rocky. Chad Rocky? Chad Rocky, the bad Realtor? Rocky.
Rocky, Chad, you got too Rocky many names. The Realtor? Yeah, I know, too many.
Yeah.
Rocky the Realtor on Instagram, but Chad the Dad, I've gotten that one many times.
Yeah, so tell it. I think you got Chad the Dad before you even had Olive, which just like triples down your dad.
Yeah, that's true. You may have actually started Chad the Dad, to be honest. So
did I start it? That doesn't surprise me because I like names that rhyme, and so Chad the Dad rhymes, man. What's been new with you, man? Any big undertakings in your world?
Let's see. Not really. Kind of just full steam ahead. Working with buyers, agent life, got two under contract, closed one last week, running around inspections, went to a showing this morning with a investor client. So yeah, doing my thing.
Just living the dream. Dude, I have a funny story that I was up here, this is a client I had in Idaho, not in Denver, but we went under contract. And went through, like we went through inspections. Inspection actually wasn't that bad, surprisingly, based on how old the house was. But there was like one thing, there was mold in the attic that we wanted to get addressed. And the listing agent was like the meanest listing agent I've ever talked to. He was like super condescending. He kept telling me how he's been in the business for 37 years, and blah, 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 blah. You know, one of those guys. And I know he's been in the business for 37 years because he has an AOL email. Just leave it at that, right? And he was telling me that I didn't know how to email. He was like yelling at me for like, you know, he's like, maximum a mold situation will be $2,000 or $3,000. And like, I'm like, well, I've seen mold situations in the 20s. Yeah. And then he was like, you know, we wanted the seller to like run the sewer scope because it didn't go through when we tried to do it. And he's like, I've never once in my 37 years had anyone ask me to rerun a sewer line. And I'm like, really? Because we have been doing this for like 6 months and they've seen that. And so I went and I asked him and I'm like, he ended up canceling our contract because he thought I was incompetent, which is obviously, I don't think that's true. But I asked Michael, I was like, Michael, to me, this doesn't make sense how you've never seen mold and you've never had anybody ask this. I know you've been in business for 37 years, but how many deals have you done in those 37 years? And he was like, oh, now you're just attacking me, Craig. And then he hung up the phone. That was the last I talked to him.
Wow. Always something new in this business.
It's always something new. And I have to say that usually I'm not the one to, I usually try to stay pretty professional, but this guy, I just like really had it out for him for some reason. So anyway, yeah, that was my kind of funny story. But so stuff that we got to deal with that, you know, you guys buying and selling don't have to deal with because you hopefully never have to talk to that other agent. But yeah, anyway, the show today, Mr. Paul Sparks, we got a great show for you. I love that he is about 7 to 8 years into his journey because it's short enough where we can still talk about it in segments and still pretty relevant in his early days, but long enough so that all the listeners can see where their kind of next steps are. I'd say Paul is, you know, two or three steps ahead of most people who listen to this show. And so, yeah, so take a listen to Paul's story, listen to the beginning. He didn't start out perfectly. How he, again, continued to not be perfect in the middle. He's getting better now, but I'm sure he's going to make some pivots later on as well. So with that being said, let's bring Mr. Paul Sparks onto the show.
This episode of Investify was brought to you by the FI team, a team of investor-friendly agents that service all 50 states. If you are looking to house hack, to invest, grow your portfolio, and want a true investor-friendly agent on your side, go to thefiteam.com and click get started. And we can't wait to have a good conversation with you.
Paul Sparks, welcome to the show, my friend. How are you doing today, bro?
I am good. I am excited because it's starting to warm up a little bit here in Denver. It's not quite so cold, which means my projects are not mud pits anymore. So it's a good day. It's a good day. Yeah. How about you guys?
we're saying this in February. That's totally a fake spring. You've got like three or four more fake springs until actual spring appears. So
the 12-day calendar has like 50s. I saw some 60s in there. So I don't know. But yeah, we got the April or May 12-inch yeah. storm coming for sure.
Wasn't it a couple of years ago? It snowed literally in June. It was like June 23rd. It was like summer and it snowed. I remember that. I was like,
all the trees are cracking because the snow is so heavy. Yeah, exactly. That's coming. It's a fall spring. Yeah. You're exactly right.
Yeah. So enjoy it. Enjoy it. I'm not saying don't enjoy it. But speaking of fall springs, Paul, this is a horrible transition, but that's what my MO is, by the way. Tell us about your beginnings. I guess spring is like the beginning of new life, a new season. Tell us the beginning of Paul Sparks' real estate career and kind of when you made that switch from like traditional life to the entrepreneur life.
Yeah. Well, so like most people who get into real estate, they come not usually from real estate. They're probably in some corporate role. You know, you like a good little boy, you go to college and you get your degree. I got an engineering degree. I went to work in sales. I did this for almost 10 years. And as I started making more money, I started having people be like, actually, it was my wife at the time. I told this at y'all's meetup the other day, but you know, she was basically like, hey, it'd be cool to not keep coming over to your frat house. Maybe you should get a house, you know, buy your own house. So I don't think I really gave a whole lot of thought to it before I had a girl worth trying to impress. But that was the catalyst to me buying my first house. And I didn't know anything about house hacking. I had some money saved up. In fact, I ended up buying a brand new townhome, for those who are familiar with Denver, in the West Colfax neighborhood, which is now Townhouse City. So I bought a house and, you know, my girlfriend at the time moved in with me. And I started discovering bigger pockets. In fact, I believe I read your book a long time ago, Craig. And it was like, oh, there's a name for this. They call this something. Now, I wasn't doing it exactly the way that, you know, you were sort of advocating, which is you buy a house, you renovate it, you put as many bedrooms in there as you can, and you fill it with people who are going to pay you to live in that house. Well, I didn't perfectly do that. You know, I saw it as a huge win to one, have a place that I could call my own, and two, to really only be paying half my mortgage. So yeah, it was good.
Wouldn't it be funny if you went from like this frat house with living a bunch of people and your wife's like, you need to stop living like this and buy a house of your own. And then you buy a house of your own and then rent it out to your bros and it's still a frat house, but now at least you own it.
Yeah. So that option was never, it was never really an option for me. And you know, it's just, I guess my point of saying this is, your first deal's not perfect. My second deal wasn't perfect. You know, I bought that first house. I realized, oh, this is like, there's a whole thing to this. You can buy a house, put somebody in it, you move out. So what I did is I bought a house, another one, a block over. It was another brand new townhome. And in fact, what I really like about new townhomes is you have a year warranty and your CapEx budget is very, very minimal because of that. So as someone who really only had about enough money to put the down payment down, it was advantageous for me.
I think there might be some foreshadowing, a little bit of bias here, but we'll wait to hear the rest of the story.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so, you know, I bought another one.
Whoa. Okay. Before we go too much further, we can't let you get past the, Chad, you know what this sounds like?
I sure do.
The
real deal.
All right, Paul, we need to get all the details on this first deal you did. Don't care if it was a crazy good investment or not. Don't even care if you knew what house hacking was. But like, you said it was a townhome. You said it was in the West Colfax area. How did you save up for the down payment? How much did you put down? Did you rent it out? Just give us all the details of that deal.
Absolutely. So I bought that house for $465,000. You can't buy a townhouse in West Colfax that's a 2-bed, 2.5-bath for anywhere close to that anymore. I believe I put down $22,000. You know, it was 3.5%. I used a FHA loan that eventually I converted to a conventional loan.
What year was this?
This was 2018. So, you know, what, 6 years ago? And I went new, not because, I mean, first of all, like that's a preference of mine. I just like new things. I like new houses. I grew up in the Southeast where things were just newer. Here in Denver, you know, you have a lot of these older homes. So part of it was a preference of mine. Part of it was also just, again, I did not have if a water heater went out or if there was a leak or something. I don't have an extra 10 grand. You know, that was the like 22,000 plus the 10,000 I had in my bank account. Outside of that was pretty much all I had to get into this house. I remember I had like a 3.5, I think it was actually 3.8% interest rate. And then of course I ended up refining that down into, it was a 2.7% interest rate. I mean, it's like, good God, like what happened for those few years? But, you know, I remember I said the same exact thing. Like I was borderline being able to afford that payment at the time. I think it was like $2,800. That was more than I was spending on my rent. That was, you know, a really kind of a, well, what are you going to do about this? And it's like, well, maybe I can't afford this all on my own, but having someone, you know, help offset that cost was an obvious choice, right? And I think that's where most people start is, yeah, I mean, of course, with the interest rates where they are, if you're buying in a market like Denver, I mean, it's an expensive market. This is an appreciation market. It's not a cash flow market, right? Mm-hmm. So that house that I bought for $465,000, eventually I sold, I think it was 2-3 years later. I actually just, how do I say this? When I went full-time in real estate, I needed to take some chips off the table to pad my own business. So I sold that house 2 years later for, you know, no capital gains. I made it like $100,000 on it. It's like, that was the real value in that home, was not the quote cash flow. It was the appreciation that I gained in a market that has consistently gone up 4% every single year for the last 30 years.
Yeah, so if I'm gathering this correctly, right? You bought this house. It was a 2-bed, 2.5-bath. It was a nice place in a nice area, and you did rent out a bedroom to help, just to help offset the mortgage. Did you do that or no?
Yeah, it was my bedroom that my girlfriend, now wife, was in with me. I didn't rent it out the other. You know, you get my point.
Okay, gotcha. So you basically just like, you just had a place to live, and you were paying a probably maybe even a little more than you would have been paying in rent. And you still made $100,000 in 2 years. That's like a $50,000 salary per year. I think the average person in America makes like $45,000 a year, right? Mm-hmm. So you're making like what the average person makes just on one asset in appreciation. And we tell people this all the time. It's like, if you can get something in Denver to just break even, you're going to be like crazy, crazy ahead. So you mentioned you sold that. So let's say you bought it in 2018. You lived there for 2 years. You did the whole capital gains thing, 2 out of 5. Can you explain that a little bit? The 2 out of 5 didn't pay capital gains tax.
Yeah, if you live in a house for 2 years out of a 5 in a, you know, time frame, then the IRS basically says, well, we will give you a tax credit for that. You won't be taxed on the gain after you sell it. So that, in my mind, is just a hack for wealth. You know, buy a house, live in it for 2 years, sell it, take all that money and do whatever you want with it. You can roll it into another house. You can use it for your own business like I did, but it's just a tool. These are all just tools on your board. And, you know, accumulating these assets in a high appreciation market. Again, it's like what I got distracted by is the folks in the Midwest who are talking about all this cash flow, cash on cash return, all this sort of stuff. And that's just not the play here. You know, it's not that it doesn't work. It just means you've got to start reading the field of play that you're actually on. And in Denver, it's not cash flow, it's appreciation.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, just being on bigger pockets, there's this, or more so even just bigger pockets, but this 1% rule. And some people have that stuck in their head, which that's not the case for every part of the country, to your point. And so there's cash flow areas of the country, lower price, low appreciation, and there's higher appreciation, lower cash flow. But like you said, just reading, kind of knowing your area and taking advantage of what cards are dealt to you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people, when they first get started, there's kind of the like, oh, just like only buy for cash flow, only buy for cash flow, only buy for cash flow. And that worked a few years ago. Like you could cash flow it pretty easily in almost any market as long as you got creative. And in Denver, it's getting harder and harder. In any market that is getting harder and harder to cash flow, it means the appreciation is likely getting better and better too. And what people don't think about is the longer term view, like a 5 or a 7. Let's look at a 5 or 7 year time horizon. You house hack once a year for 5 years. Now that first house that you bought 6, 7, 8 years later is probably $100,000 to $250,000 more than what you bought it for. So you've got that, right? Or you could have gone to a different market and got $200 a month and have $2,000 a year extra in cash flow. But what they don't tell you is that in 7 years, when you're maybe ready to retire or you're done with all this stuff, why don't you sell your $250,000, get your $250,000 of equity by selling your house in Denver, moving it to these more cash flowing markets. And now it's just a, it's just like the nitrous oxide, right? Mm-hmm. To your investment. So then you can get to your cash flow number a lot quicker.
Yeah. Well, spot on, right? It's like a downshift sort of. It comes back to, I think some people are stepping over dollars to pick up pennies. You know, they're worried about how do I cash flow this $300-$500 a month or $1,000 a month? And I'm like, well, Denver appreciates at a 4% clip, which means if you buy a $500,000 home, that's what, 20 grand a year, like on average. So mm-hmm. that's almost $2,000 a month just in the appreciation. But of course, we were all taught, do not underwrite based on appreciation. That's not a way to look at deals. It's got a cash flow, because what happened in 2008, everybody got burned. So I'm not suggesting from a, let's say from a purely investment standpoint, like if I was going out and buying a rental, yeah, it needs to cash flow. Like even if it's just a little bit, because you don't want to be in a position where you're underwater, but we're not necessarily talking about that. We're talking about a primary residence. So you can take a lot more risk with that, because you got to have a place to live anyways. That's my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a primary residence as like, even like a house hack, right? Or whatever. Like if you're paying $700 a month to live in this house while you're living in it, like it's a pretty dang good deal, right? Yep. And so it's okay. But when you move out, you want it to at least be kind of breaking even. And if it is losing money, right? I kind of made this analogy the other day. I had a client that was, he's like, hey, I'm thinking about selling my house. And I'm like the worst realtor ever, because I always convince people to not sell their house. And so I'm like, well, before you sell your house, like, let's just take a look at if you got a HELOC on the house and use that to put the down payment, he would essentially be losing $250 a month. And I was like, well, let's assume that you didn't have a house right now. But if I said, hey, I'm going to give you this house for $250 a month, would you take it? Most people would say yes, right? And when you think about what gets you $250 a month, I mean, a car payment is not even $250 a month. Shoot. Some of the software that we have is more than $250 a month, right? And so like that's what you're getting to buy a house. So I think you need to just look at it from the bigger perspective. And ultimately, anything else that you pay $250 a month for is not increasing in value, whereas real estate 100% is.
I mean, you tell me, what's easier, to stack up a bunch of deals where you're making a few hundred dollars a month in cash flow, or a deal you can sell that in 2 years you're taking $100,000 off the table? You know, it's like, there's just not one right or wrong way to do this, as you both know. And I'm sure you work with your clients to try to understand that. But when you're starting out, you're just so terrified of, well, it has to cash flow, passive income. You know, we've been taught that phrase. And it's like, well, you know, really, if you start looking at it as a chessboard, and these are all tools and, you know, pieces on this board, and sometimes you have to maneuver things, it's like, well, buying in a market that appreciates on average 4% per year, with the median price point around 600, like you're gonna make some appreciation over a 5 to 7 year period, right? That's pretty predictable.
Yep. Absolutely. Awesome. So you took this 100 grand. Let's get to that. So you took this 100 grand from the first purchase you bought. And what did you do? What did you do next with it?
Wow. So I guess a couple things happened. That money was used to fund some of the, I mean, you guys know, I've known both of you guys for quite a while now. You've seen me evolve as a real estate investor. So this had, I mean, we could go into that if you'd like, but long story short was, at the time I was doing a lot of off market direct to seller type activity, where we were, at one point I was spending $40,000 a month in total overhead, you know, direct mail and pay-per-click and cold calling and texting, trying to find homeowners that wanted to sell their house at a discount, so that I could buy it and either wholesale it to another investor, or, you know, do some fix and flips I was flipping at the time. So really, it was like my foray into figuring out what I liked and didn't like, what I was good at inside the real estate world. And I needed some gas in the tank, frankly. So I used that deal, that first house, as, well, yeah, maybe I could have borrowed against it, but I need the cash. Like I'm interested in just taking this, again, like a chessboard. It's not checkers. It's not always moving everything forward. Sometimes it's like you're kind of sacrificing one of your pieces in order to reallocate it to something else. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. So you sold that property, $100,000. You started this, it was like a wholesaling company, right?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Did you go right into spending 40 grand on that a month?
No, man, no. Yeah. So, you know, just like everybody, you figure out you just got to start somewhere. So I started with what I knew, which was sales, frankly. I'd done that for a decade. And so that seemed like the logical place to start was, how do I buy a house? That I can do that. Yeah.
Was like the transition when you sold it then, and obviously you moved into a new house, was that found wholesaling, or where did you move after you sold the original one?
So I bought the second house before I actually left my job. So it kind of requires a little bit of a story. So again, I was a corporate guy. I was in sales. Long story short is I was getting ready to close a really big deal with United Airlines. I'd spent years like building this business case. I'll spare you the details. We were supposed to take our big purchase order from them in March of 2020. We had all of our approvals and sign-offs in February. And then, of course, COVID hit and they were like, we have to put this project on pause. So when, you know, I had bought another townhome maybe a year before that in 2000, I guess. The years kind of run together. It's hard to remember. I think actually the first house I bought in 2017, I bought the second one in 2019. So this was just money that I was making. I was in sales, you know, everybody knows you can make decent money in sales. I was just, you know, making money, buy a house. When my hand got forced in 2020, it was like, okay, well, this is not good. It's probably this whole business and this whole industry is going to be in a slump for a few years. So I really, my hand was kind of forced. That same year, I decided to take out absolutely as much debt as I possibly could, knowing that I was going to be leaving my job and wouldn't be able to get debt for another 2 years. So I bought an Airbnb, and my wife and I used, I guess we were still unmarried at the time, but we used her ability to get the loan, and I funneled a lot of my capital into that deal. So again, what we did is the writing was on the wall. We're going to have to leave. It's like, you're kind of at a make or break point. Like, what are you going to do here? And it's like, well, let's go full at this. But before I do, let me squeeze absolutely as much debt out as I possibly could. And I'm glad I did, because all of my loans are, you know, under 3%, and they cash flow really well. And that cash flow, I got that up to, between the Airbnbs and the couple rentals that I had, I was making maybe $6,000-$7,000 a month in total cash flow, which was like enough to make this leap. So that's how it looked.
Yeah. So did you just buy these with 20% down then?
The first one I bought with 3.5%. The second one I bought with 5%. The third one I bought with 20%, which was my short-term rental. And the last one that is actually the house that we still live in, so another 3.5%. So, you know, we're putting anywhere from 20 to 30K down on most of these deals. On one of them, I popped a, you know, 100 down on.
Okay. And this is all made just from your job, from being a killer salesman.
Pretty much.
So that's also, like, you know, another thing to talk about here is you hear people poo-poo W-2 jobs, and I do it as much as the next guy. But W-2 jobs have a place, especially if you're just getting started. And to get your first two or three deals while a W-2, it makes it insanely easier. I can't tell you how hard it's been for me to get traditional financing on deals ever since I quit my W-2. So, I don't think I quit my W-2 until I did my third or fourth deal. So it's, it takes time.
Yeah, Paul, you made a good point of, like, knowing you're going to leave from an underwriter perspective, like, they don't need to know that. And so for anybody listening, like, it's a great point of, you got a job, you take advantage of it. You get that loan when you can, when you have, you know, when you're fundable at that point. Another thing too, on those same lines, is, like, you know, girlfriend, we see this all the time, of a great scenario is when you have a couple not married, the girlfriend can get a house, the boyfriend can get a house. So every 6 months you can get a house, and you do that before you get married is very, very advantageous as well. So just want to point that out.
Yeah, Grace. So my wife, Grace, and I, we did that. Like, I was house hacking a few years before her, but she bought her first one in 2020. I bought one in 2020. She bought one in 2021. I bought one in 2021. So for like a 2 year period there, we were moving every 6 months. And like, it's not fun, but is $200,000-$300,000 in a couple of years fun? That's fun.
Right. Right? I've heard you guys talk about the what do you call that? The comfortability versus profitability seesaw. Yeah. You know, and it's like, that's a preference thing, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I'm just, first, it's Super Bowl. The Super Bowl just happened, right? People see the Kansas City Chiefs, and I'm not a Chiefs fan, but see the Kansas City Chiefs in the parade winning the Super Bowl. And there's 31 other teams that say, oh, that is really fun, right? What they don't see is all the extra work, all the extra film they watched, all the extra practice they did, all the things that took them to get to that spot that was not fun. And so you see me, you see Paul here, you see Chad here, and like, yeah, it would be fun to be on a podcast or be in our position, but like, there's a lot of not fun stuff that we had to do to get there. And so just be prepared to do the not fun stuff.
Should we compare scars at a certain point?
We could, we should, yeah.
Because that's what it is, right? I think that is, you know, it's fear and uncertainty that keeps people from starting. And here's just, I mean, my opinion is, there's the risk profile of buying a house hack is just so ridiculously low that what keeps people from doing it is their own heads. You know, it's like you're inside your own head. And we hear stuff. Yeah, I'm sure you guys deal with this all the time as agents. Yeah, but the interest rates and yeah, but, you know, the market. And so, you know, the prices are so high. Well, guess what? They said the same thing in 2017. They said the same thing in 2019. Mm-hmm. Same thing in 2020 and 21. And I mean, it's like, now we're kind of getting enough, you know, trips around the sun where it's like, I've been hearing this song for, you know, almost what, 6 years I've been doing this now. It's like the conditions, what does Jim Rohn say? It's like, it's not the wind, it's the set of the sail or something like that. The conditions are what they are. You can't complain because it's winter or because it's spring or whatever. It's like the seasons are what they are. So your job is not to complain about it. Your job is to set the sail.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah. Quit trying to time the market. Quit trying to time it perfectly. Just go and do something.
Yeah. And it's, and do something in a scale. Like everybody wants to talk about, oh, like I want $10,000 a month in passive income, or I want however much. And I'm like, well, great. Well, how much do you have right now? I'm like, well, none. I'm like, then forget about that. Just go get a base hit. Like just go get something going, because you don't know what you don't know at the beginning. You know, there's a quote that I said this to Chad recently is most. So this was a child psychologist that said this. Her name, the phrase is most prefer the certainty of misery to the misery of uncertainty. Most people would rather stay in the position that they're in, even though it's not really serving them, but because they know what to expect, they stay there because being uncertain of like, well, what's going to happen if I buy this deal? There's a lot of uncertainty in that. And that's really difficult for most people. So if you can get over that idea of like the certainty of misery, like it's a little overstated maybe, but I think the idea is like, if you're looking to get started in investing, it's like, it's going to be uncertain. It's going to be uncomfortable. Welcome to the party.
Yeah, that first one is always the most difficult. I mean, you just got to pull the trigger of, and I always say too, like the short-term sacrifices and short-term pain for the long-term gain of, do you want to work to your 60? Most people say no. Like, okay, if you don't want to work to your 60, what do you got to do today to not have that happen? And it's take a little bit of risk and surround yourself with the people that are doing what you want to do and learn. But there's then the balance of like analysis paralysis versus pulling the trigger. And at some point, you just got to rip the Band-Aid off, pull the trigger. Then once you get your first, you'll learn so much. And then you get your second and third, and then you're not working till you're 60.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
We hope this episode is inspiring you to take action. If you're thinking about becoming a real estate agent or an agent who wants to join an investor-friendly team, just hit me up on Instagram at the Fi Guy, because we are growing our team in Denver, Seattle, San Diego, and Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, but also adding to our network in all 50 states. And if you didn't already know this, the Fi team provides a super supportive environment with one-on-one coaching, accountability, and ongoing training to help develop kick-ass, rock star, investor-friendly real estate agents. So hit me up on Instagram at the Fi Guy, and we'll set up a time to chat. Can't wait to chat with you.
All right, Paul. So first one, you bought and sold. That was essentially the starting point of your business. You had a couple of rentals that you picked up along the way. And so I'm curious to hear kind of about the wholesaling company. And so you started it. Did you start it on your own? Did you have mentors? How did you get into that, and where did it go from there?
You know, my background is sales. That's all I've ever done. I like to say like that's really only good thing that I'm good at, frankly. But what I am really good at is recognizing where value exists. And so there's a framework that I call it the deal triangle. So any, you know, any deal, like I'm talking about more of an active type of deal, not necessarily house hacking, but there's three sides to every project. I guess it would apply to house hacking too. There's the first side is sourcing. How do you find a good deal? Mm-hmm. The second side is funding. Well, how do you get the debt, the equity that's needed to take it down, the down payment, the loan, all that sort of stuff. The third piece is the construction, the operations. Who's building it? Who's doing the construction? And so when you look at, let's just take fix and flips, for example. You got to have somebody to source the deal. You got to have somebody to fund the deal and somebody to actually operate it. Well, when I looked at this, I said, well, where do I add the most value on this deal triangle? I don't know anything about, I mean, these hands are soft. Like I don't know anything about construction. I didn't at the time. I do now. And I didn't have any money, really. The only value that I could see was being able to source these deals. So that's where I started because I felt like that was where I could add the most value. And I did everything. I tried all the mentors, paid for every coach. I mean, I probably spent multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars in the first couple of years educating myself. I don't know that I would have done that again the same exact way. Kind of is what it is. Like, but here's what I learned. Is what you start doing in real estate doesn't have to be what you continue doing in real estate. What I found was, I'll reserve my own comments about what I think about a lot of wholesalers, because frankly, it's a pretty slimy business, if I'm being honest. There's lots of people who do it the right way. Let me preface with saying that, but there's also a lot of bad actors in that business. And what I found was sitting in front of a homeowner that's in a highly distressed personal financial situation was very difficult on me emotionally. It was something I took it home with me. It was very hard to separate yourself from, you know, a 75-year-old woman whose husband's just passed away. She's, you know, having this really terrible life event and needs to sell her house, and I'm trying to buy it as deep as I possibly can. And it's like, gosh, this was just it was a tough thing, I think, for me. And so I just realized, like, you know, that's not where my skill set lies. It is more on the capital raising. That's what I did for a decade, was putting large projects together with some of the largest companies in the world. And I don't regret that time, because I sort of describe anybody who's trying to go full time into real estate. You know, there's this phrase everybody says, like, burn the boats and go all in. Frankly, I'm not a huge fan of that, because if I had done that, I'd still be a wholesaler today. Right. And I think at the beginning of your business, when you're starting either full time or you're starting to kind of buy things, you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you like. You don't know what you're good at necessarily. So I use a framework I call a soft offense. It's sort of like if you guys picture a Jenga board, you know, if you're playing Jenga, you'd be a really bad Jenga player if you just, you know, like that's the one and you just mash at it. Right. That's not how you play Jenga. You kind of go and you tap on the blocks, you find the one that's loose and you pull that one out, right? So if I could give any advice to anybody who's starting new, it's like, you don't necessarily need to go all in and burn the boats, right? It's okay to try a few things. I tried wholesaling. I tried fix and flips. I tried rentals and Airbnbs. I had 6 Airbnbs at one point in time. Like, now I'm doing townhome developments. It's sort of just like, Let the information kind of lead you towards what you actually like. So yeah, I'm really glad I did wholesaling, because I learned that I'm not a great wholesaler. That's not what I'm good at. That's not where my skill set lies, and that's not what makes me happy. And you only find that by kind of pressing on a couple different things.
I will say this, and Paul, I've kind of been following your journey for a few years, probably since you started the wholesaling business. And for the record, from my perspective and from my wife's perspective, who actually looked up to your wholesaling company, we thought you were killing it. Like, we thought it was great. We thought you loved it. And I'm not saying this as like, this is so everyone knows, is that what you see on Instagram or on billboards, or I remember seeing a billboard with your name, with Pony Hill on it. And so it doesn't mean that like, that's the highlight, right? And so no, like we said, like, with the Super Bowl and the Chiefs being on the stage there, right? Like, it looks really good and sexy. It looks like they're crushing it. But on the back end, like, there might be a lot of trouble that you're not seeing. And so don't just assume that it is the right way. And it's okay. Like, how did it feel to have to like let the wholesaling go after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and all that time and money into doing it? Like, does that humbling at all to you? Like, how did that feel for you?
Extremely difficult. you know, there's like a framework, a phrase that we say, it's called naming the puppy. So, you know, it's sort of like you go to a pet store, you walk in and there's all these puppies right there. And what does the guy that's there try to get you to do? He's like, well, I'll pick this puppy up and, you know, you should give it a name. We're going to name this one Nikola Jokic right here, right? And like, oh, wow, look how cute this puppy is. And what does he say? Take it home. Like, if you don't like it, you can always bring it back. Well, what's the chances you take that puppy home and then it ever comes back to the store? It's zero. I don't know who can take a puppy home and bring it back. But that's the problem, is we name the puppy in all these areas of our life. We take these puppies home and then we never give them back because our identity is now attached to it. Because, well, what's everyone going to think? They're going to think that you're a quitter or you failed or this, that, and the other. So these tricks and these, you know, mental games that are, it's not reality. These are tricks that are played on you. And certainly from the outside, like even from the inside, that business was not successful. It just wasn't the right fit for my own, like, I didn't enjoy it. I wasn't so committed to one thing that I decided. And I guess my point is when you're getting into real estate, your first couple years, the rate at which you're learning and getting exposed to opportunities and options is so fast. So it's like, reserve the right to change your mind. You know what I'm saying? If you can't be someone that is willing to change their mind in light of new information, I don't know how successful you're going to be long term, and or you might build a box/prison around your life because you said you were going to do this. So by God, you're going to go to the grave and do it. It's like, no, I just don't think that's the recipe for success. It's like, it's okay to change things. It's okay to adapt and it's okay to learn.
I'm just keep on thinking of like people in W-2 jobs of, that's just like I feel like the American society of like, you just, like you said, go to college, get a job, work that job. You know, I've stayed in my job for 40 years and then you retire and there's no other, like a lot of people's mindset, there's no other option. This is the job I have. This is what I do. And then you're stuck in it for 20, 30 years. To your point though, like there's other ways and don't be afraid to change. Like, sure, change is okay.
And it's like, it's a bias that we call loss aversion, you know? It's like, but I've spent all this time and this energy building this thing. So like, I'm going to lose so much if I do something different. But that's, again, that's not reality. Continuing to do, what is that phrase? Like continuing to do something you know that doesn't work is the definition of insanity, or whoever said that, Einstein maybe. That's, I guess, what I realized, Craig, was that I was just continuing to guarantee that every single day I was going to come home stressed out. It's just at a certain point, you have to kind of recognize that you got to change something.
I don't know why, but this like, this Led Zeppelin quote is in my head from one of their songs that I used to like love as a kid. And the way it goes, and this is what it says. It says, then as it was, then again, it will be. And though the course may change sometimes, rivers always reach the sea, right? And so if you think about the way a river runs, you could be in the middle of Kansas, right? And you need, and that river is going to reach the ocean. Now it may go through a bunch of different rivers. It might take the Mississippi and then the Ohio and then the Colorado, whatever, right? I don't really know my river geography that well. But the point is that like you are in a river with Bunny Hill. And instead of sticking to that same river, you decide to pivot. And it doesn't mean you're going to a different place. You're still going to build the wealth and the ultimate lifestyle. And the reason why you're starting these businesses is going to be the same. You're just getting there a different way. And that's okay, because almost everything changes.
Right. Well, it's really great analogy. It's like getting really clear on what you want out of life, but being very open to, I call it the universe, right? To the how, because our best plans right now are just the best guess of what we believe reality to be in the future, but we don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And we have to proceed kind of keeping the loop open with the how of how this all works out. Because again, what you know now, I mean, it's like in year one in real estate versus year three in real estate. I mean, it's not a linear progression in your skills and understanding. It's like, boom, like a big, you know, exponential curve. Like, so how could you have known about this at that time when you laid out this perfect 10-step plan of how many you're going to do exactly this thing? And when you get kind of locked into that, you close yourself off to the universe and the infinite possibilities that exist. So it's clear on the what, completely unclear on the how.
I just got to jump in for a second. We're on episode 183, and the guest said, great analogy to Craig. We may have set a record. That's never been said before.
Hey, we're marking this down on the calendar. We're recording this on Valentine's Day. I think Paul is just feeling some extra love for us today.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Appreciate you, Paul. So the wholesaling company, right? Like you know you're a good businessman. Like, and sorry, I didn't mean to say that it wasn't successful, but I guess from my perspective, I thought you were enjoying every second of it, like from just what I've seen on the exterior. And that's clearly not the case. And so when did you decide to shut that down? Like, and during what time period did you have that? And then where did you go after that?
So, you know, we spent 2021, like I'm all in, you know, we tried everything. I think I had like 6 or 7 people working for me at one point in time. You know, we were doing, like I said, about a $40,000 a month total overhead inside the business, which felt like a noose to me at the time, that just like a couple bad months, and I had a couple bad months, can really like, so it's just very stressful having that consistent, you guys get this as agents, you know, you never quite know when your next deal is. So sometimes it's like, it's a little stressful. But what I realized ultimately back to the deal triangle is my skill set is less on negotiating off-market deals and more on business-to-business sales. Right. So I came from the world of business to business. What I would consider direct to seller is B2C, you know, business to consumer. But I'm much better at, let's just say, raising capital is another way of saying that. So I started finding other people on the triangle that were really excellent at what they did. And it started with a couple what we call pop tops here in Denver. So, you know, I raised my first $1 million. Turns out, you know, this business is all about relationships. This was a family that I had grown up with, and I baled hay for this family in high school. So it's just kind of funny how things come full circle. You never quite know. It's always the farmers, by the way, that have the money. So keep that in mind if you are trying to raise money out there. It's farmers. Talk with them. But my point being is, you know, my skill set was raising this capital. So I raised $1 million. We went out in Sloan's Lake. For those who aren't familiar with Denver, it's really close to downtown. We bought a house for $600,000-ish. We put about $600,000 into it to renovate it and sold it for $1.8 million. And it was like, whoa, okay. Forget about the volume-based business. That's not what I did well. You know, again, back in the corporate world, I was hired. I would spend 2 years to sell one deal. You know, it was a $15, $20 million deal, but that was always my kind of appetite for risk. Not everybody's going to, you know, think that way, but that was really the first, oh, okay, back to Jenga. I pressed a block that now was really loose and it's like, right. Oh, okay. So I'm looking for more stuff like this. How can I raise money, find people that are excellent at building, and find people that have deals that can just bring it to me? So I started that slowly, that transition into more or less what I'm doing now, which is basically capital raising.
Mm. Okay. Okay. So with the pop top stuff, like your main piece to that was raising that 600 grand, say. Who found the deal and who did the construction?
So one of the townhomes that I bought, the second townhome that I bought, the guys that built that, I got to know them really well. I was like, wait, so what is it that you guys do? You just build these things and you're making how much money on these? I started recognizing the opportunity that was there. And so an opportunity kind of came about where this guy called me up. He's like, I've got this deal. Hassan is his name. He's my business partner now. We're building these townhomes together as well. But back then, he did not have the cash to take this deal down. So he called me up and he's like, hey, I found this project in Sloan's Lake, but I really have no way to take it down. And I was like, how much do we need? It's like, well, 600 to buy the land and another 400 to, you know, get the construction loan, basically. We wanted to fund all of it, you know, in debt. And I was like, so we need $1 million. Well, let me see if I can go get that. And so I started, you know, this enter the sales process where you're making calls all day and you're talking to investors about what their goals are and what they're trying to do. And I finally kind of knocked on the right door and they're like, yeah, we'd be interested in funding that. We've known you for a long time. It's super awkward picking up the phone and calling somebody you haven't talked to in 10 years. And like, you know, but if you want to be successful in sales and in capital raising, as we all know, pick up the phone. That's how business is done. So that's the way that I figured out how to add value. And again, what I recognized is there's three sides to a triangle, and you don't need to be the one that brings all three. Mm-hmm. Just bringing the capital got me 50% of that first deal.
Mm-hmm. How does that conversation go? Like let's say you haven't talked to them in 10 years, they're picking up their phone. They're like, Paul Sparks.
Sure.
That name sounds familiar, but like, forget who he is. Like, how do you like even start that conversation?
I love this. Can we talk sales for a sec?
Let's do it.
All right. So first of all, if you're raising capital, you never talk about the deal that you're raising for in the first conversation, ever. That's a cardinal sin. Mm-hmm. So the first conversation, you're using what I call, so if you notice, I have a lot of frameworks and stuff that I use. It helps me like kind of consistently make good decisions. And one of them we call the solvable problem. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what are you actually trying to accomplish in your life? You know, I see this mistake made so often by capital raisers. They just get on a call and they just start pitching their deal. And it's like, I don't even know what you want. I don't even know what you like. I don't know what you're trying to accomplish in your life. How active are you trying to be? You're just interested in selling your deal clearly. So that's all you're doing is you're pitching, because not every deal is right for every investor. And if you don't understand what they're actually trying to accomplish, then you're just slinging mud at the wall and hoping stuff sticks. So that very first conversation is not an agenda. You're not trying to sell anything. You're trying to reestablish a relationship. How the hell are you? Hadn't talked to you in a while, man. I just wanted to let you know what I'm doing and find out a little bit more about what you're doing. How have you been? It's not as like you're trying to initiate that first conversation and reestablish some rapport, basically. And there's something that I heard, if you're raising capital, there's a rule that I sort of use. If I'm going to spend more than 30 seconds with you, I'm going to tell you what I do and how you can help me. And that's very uncomfortable for a lot of people when they're starting out, because they're like, well, I don't want to like hit somebody up for money. I don't want them to feel like I'm pressuring them. It's like the conversation goes like this. Hey, I'm in Denver now. You know, they knew me from when I grew up in the Southeast. I'm in real estate. We're looking for properties to buy and invest in. If you ever have any interest in anything like that, let me know. And then they say, actually, I might have interest in that. And then you start the conversation. But that is, it's not one or two conversations. It's you got to pick up the phone and call every single person that you know and tell them what you're doing and tell them how they can help you.
Yeah, it's funny because we're telling this with our agents now too, like how good your sphere is and how they're some of the best converting people because they already know, like, and almost trust you, right? Right. And so all you have to do is really get them to establish that trust. And if you're calling them for the first time in 10 years, pitching them a deal, like they're just like, no, bro, like who are you? But like right. If you become friends with them over one or two, like it takes one 30-minute conversation to just rekindle a relationship. And now they're thinking of you a lot more than they ever have probably in the last 10 years. And so, and vice versa. And they know that you'll be thinking of them more as well. And so then when a deal comes along, it's like, oh, hey, this deal just crossed my plate. Because we just talked, you ran across my mind, but it would be really awkward if you ran across my mind when we haven't talked for 10 years. Right. So I just think that human psychology perspective is really important.
One thing to add too is just curious your thoughts on like proof of concept. You know, like that first one, you've been in real estate, but maybe you haven't done like a development. But now, you know, you have the pop top, you have the development. Like, it just, I feel like spirals now. If you have the proof of concept, you have the knowledge, you have all the numbers. It just makes it that much easier. And again, going all the way back to, you just got to start somewhere. You start somewhere, and then you get proof of concept. And then if you want to raise money, like, look what I did. And it just goes from there.
You know, you're making a really good point that I'm sure I can almost like feel the questions. One of the questions I'm sure that somebody that's listening to this is thinking is like, yeah, but do you need the deal first or do you get the money first? Right? Like, how do you do that? And part of what I will tell people is when I was selling and pitching these deals, I'm not pitching my track record. I'm not pitching my ability to do anything. I was pitching Hassan. I was pitching Nate. I was pitching the guys that had built dozens of townhomes. And I'm certainly not making it sound like I'm the one doing the work. It's like, again, there's value in connecting the three pieces. In fact, that is probably the biggest value, is bringing all three of these pieces together. So a lot of times I was talking about hypothetical deals and or deals that they had done in the past. We're looking for something like this. So I always recommend anytime somebody's starting out capital raising is get a sample deal together. Like, this is the type of project that we're going to try to look for. We don't have it yet. But if I found something like this, what would you want me to do? That's the magic phrase to close these conversations. It's not an if then, it's an if what or an if how. So we talk about this project. If I found something like this, what would you want me to do? If I found something like this, how would you want me to let you know? Mm. It's a little awkward, the phrasing, but what that does is it'll get them to say like, oh yeah, I'd love to see that. You know, if you found something like this, yeah, definitely send it over. Great. There you go. End of discussion. Even if you have a deal, do not pitch it on that first call. Commission breath. You guys know about that.
Oh yeah.
You can't get, you've got to stop. Everybody can sense your neediness, right? When you have a deal and you want something from somebody, everyone can feel it from a mile away. So the first step is you're building your list of people that would be interested in an opportunity. If I found something, what would you like me to do?
Yeah. And I guess just to kind of like answer the question too, is like if you're thinking about raising money from people and you don't have a deal yet, just start talking to people and start those conversations without a deal. It makes you sound a lot more genuine when you actually do have something, right? Like you want to get people on your like investor list, and then a deal comes. And then typically, like, tell me if I'm wrong, right? This is a little bit different than the residential space, which I'm used to. But from my experience in the commercial game, it's like you find a deal, you've got like 21 days or something to try to raise that amount of money. And so you want, at that time, you want people to just pitch the deal to. And in order to get that is having those fluffy conversations before you've got the deal. Is that right?
You need, yes. So I use a framework, again, back to my frameworks, and I call it putting my investors on the lift. What I mean by that is I don't show actual deals to investors. It's all hypothetical until I see proof of funds. And then what I tell them is like, I'm putting you on the lift, which means you're not on the run yet. I'm looking for a deal that fits this certain criteria, but I need to know that you're on the lift. Means that you're not just like, you know, screwing around. Like, yeah, maybe I'm interested, maybe I'm not. It's like, no, if I found a deal that looks like this, what would you want to do? They're like, well, I'd want to move forward. Fantastic. What that means now is you show me, we discuss what you're looking for, we discuss terms, we make sure all that's hammered out, right? But I need to see that proof of funds. I'm going to put you on the lift, which means we're going to go look. It could take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to place this, but I'm going to go look for a deal like this. When I find it, I'm going to call you. I'm going to say, here's the wire instructions. One last point is that gives you so much more power when you're negotiating with the actual deal. You know you have the funds. You're not sitting here saying like, well, if I tie this up, am I going to be able to fund this? It's like, no, you've got, you know, it's like, don't let go of the branch until you got the next one in your hand kind of thing. Otherwise, as a capital raiser, your number one currency is your reputation, okay? Mm-hmm. Like doing what you say you're going to do and executing on that. And so you put yourself at a lot of risk when you try to tee it up like without having people on the lift, as I like to say.
So one question I have here too is it easier than one might imagine to find a lot of people looking for the same type of deal? Or because if you've got friends with different amounts of money, with different goals, how do you find a deal, you know, that you can place $1 million in if you've only got, let's say, 10 friends with 100 grand?
That strategy of like this typical syndication, like let me throw 10 people that all have 100 grand, that's significantly harder from my perspective than finding one lender that can throw $1 million down.
So, okay. So you're actually trying to seek people out that have got a larger amount.
The people that have 100 grand to invest are going to be your biggest pain in the ass investors, frankly. That is my experience. The less money they have to invest, the more they're going to chirp at you all day long. So when I'm looking at capitalizing a deal, I'm trying to say to myself, like, how do I do this with the least number of components possible, because there's less things to go wrong. And that's just a preference of mine. I'm not suggesting that you can't raise money 100 grand at a time. I'm just saying that you would be surprised how much faster people with $1 million, seven figures write checks than the people with $100,000 write checks. Mm-hmm.
How do you find these people that can write a $1 million check?
You already know them. They're families that you bailed hay for growing up. They're people that you have known for years in church. They're people that you knew from college or whatever. Like, the thing is, it's back to, you know, scarcity versus an abundance mindset. The money's there. You just don't know where to look. And so part of it is you got to start turning rocks over. I think everybody is looking for that rich uncle to come and save the day. But it'll surprise you where money's sitting. And you don't know until you ask. Relationships is the number one currency in this business, period. End of discussion. Like, you want to raise money, increase the quality and the amount and the size of your relationships. It's simple as that. And you have to tell people what you're doing. Like, I see so many people who, you know, they struggle with imposter syndrome. They think that they have to have 3 successful townhome projects or whatever to feel comfortable doing. That's fear, right? It's fear. And it's really all it is at the end of the day. It's like, it's okay to use what I call an authority loop. It means it's not me, it's this guy, right? I'm not going out, and when I'm raising money for my townhome projects, I'm not talking about how successful of a developer I am. I'm talking about the partners that I have, the team that I've assembled, right? Again, this is a team sport as you start going up in types of deals. And you've got to start thinking about it in terms of what you specifically bring and how do you put the team together that has what's necessary in order to actually execute on that project. And you're selling that. You're selling that. That's the product that you're selling, not your necessary experience, because everybody knows that you got to start somewhere, which means you have to find a way to leverage the relationships and the resources. And it's back to the relationships. Here we are again, right? It always comes back to that.
Yeah, this is amazing, Paul, right? Like, I think like your kind of story, like in my head, is like cut up into chunks of like beginner picking up residential type properties, house hacks, yada, yada, yada. Wholesale is part 2 of your journey. And now you're doing this townhome development part 3. And so the kind of the ducks and the dodges and the pivots that you've made this whole time just shows like, and this is a 7-year journey, right? Many people listening to this, you're on year 1, 2, or 3 of your journey. And like, know that you have no idea where you're going to be in 3 years. Like, did you ever imagine, Paul, that you would be developing townhomes 5 years ago?
Couldn't have known. Would have had no clue.
Exactly. And so like, it's just kind of funny about like how we think we have this plan and it just doesn't pan out as the way we thought it would. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question for you, Paul, is what's next, right? After this townhome stuff, what do your next 3 years look like? Or what do you think they do?
I'm sort of finding my groove after, you know, years of playing Jenga. You know, I've sort of figured out what I'm good at, what I like. And now it's time to, I think, start putting some more resources into that. So I am having a very hard time finding a deal to pencil here in Denver. So if anybody knows of any good townhome projects or any just in general, I'd love to see them, first of all, because just for, you guys know me and you probably already know this, but for the sake of those who don't, I've currently got 18 townhomes I'm building in the University Hills neighborhood. It's kind of near Denver University. This is a $10.5 million project. I want to try to do maybe 2 of those this year. I'm looking at markets like Florida, like Tampa. I'm looking at markets like Tennessee. You know, I run a small mastermind that's got people all over the country. And frankly, what I'm looking for are excellent operators so that I can stay in my lane, which is just capital raising and funnel money into their projects, right? So we can build projects in Tampa. We can do, you know, we're underwriting 160 unit multifamily apartment building in Omaha right now. My point is like, well, I don't know anything about how to do the construction. I'm not sourcing those deals, but it's back to the deal triangle. What I know how to do is bring multiple millions of dollars into these deals. I know how to get the debt. I know how to structure it with the LPs and the GPs. That's my experience, is kind of structuring this. And so again, I'm just looking for who needs what I have, who needs what I'm really good at, and how do we start putting together some teams in some markets where, frankly, Denver's a great market for earning big, giant chunks of cash. As we said, it's an appreciation market. It's not a cash flow market. But that also presents a problem, which is like, I'd really like to start getting some cash flow as well. You know, how do I start finding some other markets where maybe we're doing build to rent opportunities, or we're doing some value add multifamily? So this is really like what the next phase of kind of pressing and seeing what works is I need to find who is going to benefit most from the skill set that I bring to the table, and how do I build teams and markets where we can actually find deals, because it's really tough here in Denver.
So it sounds like you're just really tripling down now on your money, on your money raising aspect to it. And are you limiting it only to new construction builds, or like would you raise money for a 160 unit that's already standing?
Well, I would, and I literally have not made this public yet. I haven't even announced this to my group, but you guys are going to get like a little awesome, like, let me tell you something special that is really working. So
the love continues.
Yeah, I love it. So there's one of my business partners in this mastermind. His name's Dan Nicholson. He wrote a book called Rigging the Game. And Dan runs one of the top midsize accounting firms in the nation. All right. So he has 500 to 600 clients. All of them are earning $500,000 to $2 million a year. Some of them in the tens of millions, right? And so these are business owners. These are C-suite executives. They are coming into Dan's accounting firm. They are paying him dozens of thousands of dollars to build out these tax strategies and roadmaps and all this stuff. And we know real estate is the number one driver of wealth. So in every case, the doctor, Dan, is making a prescription, you need to buy real estate. But he has a problem because he can't fulfill on this. So a plan without actually being able to implement it is kind of worthless, right? So ultimately, what I'm really starting to build is we're going to be kind of building this brand called Rigging Real Estate. What this is going to be geared toward is accredited investors coming directly from Dan's accounting firm, hundreds of investors that now need to find outlets to buy real estate. So I'm sort of recognizing that the opportunity is one to, yes, have my own projects, but also to take these, you know, poor souls, just kidding, the C-suite executives who are earning $1 million plus every single year, and how do we connect them with people in markets all over the country, right? So this is what my mastermind is really kind of all about, is how do we help active investors get connected with passive accredited investors that need to make these investments. And so it's back to relationships again. That's how people make these investments. And so this is the big kind of push, I think, that's what I'm going to be making this year, is how do we build the conduit, you know, the plumbing to connect these two worlds so that these accredited investors can get connected directly with people that have opportunities.
Gotcha. That's amazing, man. It sounds, see, it's funny how like you build this thing and then it starts to serve this other thing. I mean, you didn't even talk about your mastermind much. And so what was the purpose of building that? And what's that all about? Is that to just cultivate these investors?
As you know, it's like there's only a certain amount we can cover in the short time that we have together. But ultimately, I was mentored by that, by Dan, the author of that book. He taught me how to use his operating system, what's in that book, Rigging the Game, how to use it in real estate. It transformed my business. We started teaching it to other real estate investors. I'm like, I know a lot of people who could really benefit from this. So ultimately, what we do in that group is we certify people in that operating system. And it's all about how to make better decisions, get closer to the things that you want in life. It's stuff that we're all familiar with. It's not really rocket science. We've all probably heard a lot of this stuff. But ultimately, the real connection of these two worlds lies in the fact that Dan has these clients who are, you know, being taught this operating system, and we can connect them with operators who also know this operating system. And so it's back to just open loops. I could never have known it was going to turn into exactly this, but we just started kind of stepping towards what we knew to be true. And here we are, you know, a couple years later.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Love it. Love it. Awesome, Paul. Well, hey, again, we probably could talk to you for 2 hours on diving into all this different type of stuff. But ultimately, we just wanted to share, you know, your story, especially being 7-8 years in. For the listeners who, again, are maybe 1 or 2 years in, almost everybody that I know that is 6, 7, 8 years in is like, has these progressions very similar to what Paul has had. And I feel like we kind of started around the same time, and I've done my fair share of pivots as well. Right. And so when you're listening to this, like, know that you're in chapter one, and don't compare your chapter one to Paul's chapter seven, or Chad's chapter six, or my chapter five, right? Like, you guys are still need to get through chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5. And fortunately for you, that's still in your future. Hopefully you can learn from podcasts like this, from other podcasts and educational stuff that you're listening to, so you don't need to make all the same mistakes that we've made. But Paul, this has been amazing. Before we let you go, we're going to have to go into the final part of our show, which, Chad, you know what this is called, right?
I certainly do.
It's time for the final.
The final four.
All right, kick us off, Chad.
Paul, what book are you currently reading?
Man, I'm in a Dr. Joe Dispenza rabbit hole right now. You guys ever heard of him?
I have, but I can't think of who he is. I know his name.
So anyways, this guy, Dr. Joe, he's a big quantum, like, you know, if you hear me talking about the universe and I sound a little woo-woo on this call today, it's because I'm reading Dr. Joe. So I'm blanking on the name of the book, but it's this guy, Dr. Joe, and I've read a couple of his books lately, and that's what I'm reading right now.
Cool.
What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Slow down. Slow down a little bit, right? Like, it's okay. You're in the right place. You know, I feel like for the longest time, I felt like I had to like prove myself to something. I don't know. Like, your trajectory is your own. Your journey is your own. And you don't need to compare yourself to everybody else, right? Like, play your game, I guess is another way of saying that. Play your game and be unapologetic about that.
Great.
Love that.
What is your why?
So there's a book, obviously, Simon Sinek. It's so funny. It's sitting right here. Start with why, right? Here's why I don't necessarily agree with that. I feel like that can oftentimes be an anxiety-inducing question. Like, what is your why? As if you're supposed to know exactly what your life's purpose is when you're, you know, I'm 33 years old. So there's a, again, back to frameworks. I use a framework we call repetition, intensity, purpose. It means you may not know exactly what your why is. That's okay. Go out and do the reps. Because as you engage, you'll start finding what leads to intensity, right? If I had said that my why was I want to help off-market distressed wholesalers, it's really difficult to get off that when you realize that it's not. So part of this is it's okay to go out and to hold that in like receivership, as one of my coaches calls it, and go out and start doing stuff. Like, and just because you may not know exactly what your why is, I certainly hope it expands beyond what I understand it to be now. That process, in my opinion, is constantly evolving. And that may be a little different take than, you know, you guys might have. That's been my experience, is that I don't need to know exactly what my why is in order to keep making steps forward. I'm getting clearer and clearer and sharper on what that means as I get more and more information. So it's a fairly vague answer, but I guess the point is like, I'm still figuring it out. I'm still trying to figure out what my ultimate contribution and purpose is to this. And I'm not letting that stop me. I'm taking steps forward every single day.
I think one thought here is that your why is ever changing, right? Like, you don't buy your first house hack for the same reason you're going to build a $10.5 million, you know, townhome complex. It's just not the same why. Like, you buy your first house hack to achieve financial independence and probably get out of your W-2 job. And then you've got this new base level, and now your why is greater and your world is expanding. And so allow your why to change, but you know, there just needs to be a bigger fulfillment and purpose.
Yeah.
That reminded me of one thing I always hated in the W-2 life or corporate life was, tell me what your 5-year plan is, or what's your 10-year goal. I absolutely hated that question. It's like, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do tomorrow. Like, why do I have to have a 5-year goal? I mean, you should have things out there, and you're into your point of like, why? Like, but that's always evolving. You don't need to put it in stone today and just work towards that because you don't know.
Well, and I can give you a little bit more of a tangible answer too. I sort of, when I actually answer that question, usually what I say is I like to play business like a sport, you know? I enjoy doing this stuff, like solving problems. Like, I like to do business with people that I like to play with. So ultimately, what I think about, what I'm really trying to accomplish, is how do I make the money that I need every single year to like fund the things that I want in life, so that I can play business like a sport, so that I can, because it's fun for me. Like, I don't know what to say other than it's like, I enjoy it. That's what I like to do. And that's probably going to continue evolving and changing as I do the reps, and it leads to more and more intensity. I start figuring out what that is leading towards. And right now, I'm just kind of holding that in a place of receivership.
Totally. I love that. All right, Paul, last question. Which Disney princess is the most annoying?
Gosh. Cinderella? Come on, get it together.
Cinderella. Lead me. Tell me why.
Losing your shoe. Like, come on, get it together.
Yeah, fair enough. For me, it's Snow White. I don't know if she's technically a princess or not, but I just always thought she was so annoying. Like, her voice was so annoying.
Chad? That's a really good question, guys. I like that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to say, just because Olive is all about Anna, I'm going to say we've watched that movie now 500 times, so I'm going to go with that.
Paul, where can people find out more about you?
Check me out on Instagram. You know, I kind of wear it all on my sleeve. I'm not shy. You can check me out at Paul Sparks Official on Instagram. You know, you can learn about the flips that I'm doing. I've got a couple flips here in Denver. I've got, you know, a bunch of townhomes I'm trying to sell, run this group. You can go, you know, kind of follow along there if you like.
Awesome. Paul, well, thanks so much for you know, giving us your precious time here today. I think there's a lot that we've taken out of it. And it was obviously always good to hang out with you. Good to catch up and good to hear your story from front to back.
Thanks, gents. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Paul.
See you later, man. And that was Paul Sparks. Chad, what'd you think?
It's really cool to see, because I think you and I maybe met Paul around the same time. Maybe, you know, just to see his journey, like, we kind of started the same, and just his journey unfold, like, in front of my eyes, and I've known him basically the whole time. He's just a super smart, like, mindset guy, and the power of having the right mindset, building relationships, and like a I can do it attitude, and just figure it out. That's what's taken him from buying his first house in 2017 to doing a $10.5 million townhouse project today. I mean, the world is in front of him now. Like, he's but it's a relatively short period of time, and he's crushing it.
Totally goes back to that quote by, like, Tony Robbins. I think it was Tony Robbins, where you overestimate what you do in 1 year and underestimate what you can do in five. Like, he's crushed it in the last few years. And yeah, he's a great guy. So if you guys, if you did resonate with anything Paul said here, like, go reach out to him on Instagram. You know, like, we bring people on the show that are wildly successful, but don't have a million plus followers, because we want you to reach out to them. Like, we want you to reach out to these very successful people and help you build your wealth. And so give Paul a follow. If you haven't already, please, please, please give us at Investify a rating. That would be greatly appreciated. And shoot us a DM on Instagram. When you do, leave us a rating. My name is The Fi Guy on Instagram, and chat.
Rocky the Realtor.
And we will see you all next week.
See ya.
That's it for this episode of Investify. We hope that these nuggets of real estate wisdom lead to more savvy financial planning and a clearer path towards financial freedom. For more content like this, subscribe to the show at investify.com. Don't forget to leave a rating and share it with your friends. Together, we can transform more real estate newbies into successful and clever investors. Thank you so much for listening. See you on the next one.